Welcome to the Waymaker Fireside Chat Podcast, where our purpose is to grow your life and change the world. In this episode, we sit down with Dr. Terry Major Kincaid. Dr. Major Kincaid is a double board certified neonatologist and pediatrician and serves as chair for the steering committee for African American outreach in her local chapter. Today on our podcast, we'll discuss how she got her start and focus in medicine, the current state of the healthcare industry, and so much more. Let's get started.
Hi, I'm Lewis Carr, and I'm the founder of Waymaker. And today on the Waymaker Fireside Chat, we have the privilege of talking to Dr. Terry Major Kincaid. She is double board certified neonatologist and pediatrician. Welcome, Dr. Terry.
Thanks so much for having me. Hey, Waymaker family.
Thank you for joining us. Dr. Terry, you work in an area that's so important to our community when it comes to birth rates and the maternal issues that Black and brown women have, and which are many. How did you get into that particular work?
Thanks, Lewis. I love that question. I knew very early that I wanted to be a premature baby doctor or neonatologist. My sister was a preemie, born in 1968. She weighed less than a pound, was born at Charity Hospital in New Orleans. And I was just fascinated by the fact that she was small enough to fit in your hand, that she was in a little plastic box, that my parents would go visit her on Sunday. And then one Sunday they said, okay, you can take her home. She didn't have a name for the first 3 weeks of her life. She was simply Baby Girl Major. And the fact that she even survived and is normal is a true miracle. She was born a couple of years after President Kennedy lost his son to prematurity, and his son actually was much bigger and not as premature. But the death of his son is what led to the development of neonatology as the infrastructure for neonatology in the United States. The development of neonatal intensive care units happened after his son died. His son had to be flown to Canada to be treated. So my sister benefited from the development of those ICU nurseries. So I knew I wanted to be a doctor that took care of the babies that fit in your hand. I knew that those were called neonatologists. I went to Prairie View as a pre-med major, and my pre-med advisor said, you want to be a doctor? You're going to be a doctor, even though I had never seen a Black doctor. And then I went to UCLA for medical school, came back and trained in Dallas, and was able to achieve my dream. So I like to say my sister's the first preemie I ever took care of. And every time I meet a family, I think about what my parents went through. And I think about how lucky I am to have my sister.
So, Dr. Terry, what are some of the major causes why babies are born premature?
That is the million-dollar question. So about 50% of cases, we have some idea why babies are born premature. And the other 50%, actually, people have done everything right. They just show up and they have a preterm baby. Some of the reasons why, particularly for Black and brown women, actually all women, that we can have preterm birth or preeclampsia or high blood pressure. So high blood pressure can be a reason for prematurity. They can deliver the baby early because mom's health is at risk. Diabetes can lead to delivering a baby early, having your water break, and increasing mom's risk for infection can cause the baby to be delivered early. So a lot of times the baby is being born early so that we can protect the mom from some other complication of pregnancy. Other times things are going on with the baby and the baby themselves are causing the initiation of preterm labor and are delivered early. So high blood pressure, diabetes, infection, those are some of the big reasons why. Other reasons why is that your womb or your cervix, the birth canal, could have a developmental problem where you just can't hold the baby in for a full pregnancy. And then the baby is delivered early because your womb opens prematurely. So those are some of the reasons. But there are many women who see their doctor in the morning and everything's fine, and then they come in the afternoon, and for whatever reason, they are going into preterm labor and the baby is being delivered.
So is there any advice or any process that pregnant women need to go through to sort of help out?
So one of the biggest things that I try to encourage, not just my patients, but my family, friends, my community, in terms of being advocates for our own health, we already know we have an increased risk for preterm birth. For whatever reason, we already know that Black and brown women, due to cumulative stressors, have an increased risk for preterm birth is being advocates and insisting that we're being seen when we suspect that something may be wrong. Sometimes we don't suspect at all, but there are many stories where women feel like something's not right. I think my water broke. I'm leaking. I need you to check. My baby's not kicking as much. I need you to check. I don't feel well. I need you to check when they are being turned away. So just being an advocate saying something's not right, I need you to check, and making sure that somebody is seeing you. And if you are seeing someone who's not listening to your voices, choosing a healthcare provider that is willing to partner with you in your healthcare. So we should be leading the ship for our healthcare. And we have the power to choose people who are going to honor our wishes. And so what we have learned in this maternal healthcare crisis is that empowering women to have partners go with them to visits, empowering women with resources to find providers who understand their community, who understand Black women, who understand Black and brown women, actually improves their risk for birth outcomes. And it really comes down to listening. So many women are not listened to, even when it was clear that there were markers that something was very wrong and being turned away. So just empowering people to use their voice. You're not crazy. You're not crazy. You know your body, and you deserve to be listened to, and demanding that people respect when you're asking for total consideration, respect, and control over what happens to your body and when and how.
Well, Dr. Terry, I've talked to many doctors over the course of the last few years, and most of them say resources and access to healthcare for Black and brown people are deficient. How bad is it when it comes to maternal healthcare? Is it improving? Is it flat?
So I love this question, and I agree to a certain extent. And I'm so glad you asked this question, Lewis. So resources and accesses are deficient across the board. So we learned that during the pandemic, even unrelated to maternal health. We learned that Black and brown patients suffered the worst during the pandemic. They were the least likely to get care, least likely to get on the ventilator. So those things trickle down to Black women. We already had a problem before the pandemic in terms of maternal health. Black and brown women 3 to 4 times more likely to die as a result of pregnancy, 2 to 3 times more likely to not have a preterm birth. And so we know that resources are deficient, and a lot of those resources are deficient because people who have access to public health insurance with respect to their maternal health care are not getting comprehensive treatment, or treatment stops too soon. So most people who have access to Medicaid through for their maternal health, those resources stop around 6 weeks. So some states have passed laws where you can get longer care, but we know a lot of death around maternal health happens at 8 to 12 weeks after the baby is born, because we still have issues related to hypertension or diabetes that not being addressed. So we have a lot to do in terms of making sure everybody has the right to a healthy pregnancy, making sure that people are reimbursed for taking care of Black and brown patients, making sure that we have care in rural areas. A lot of Black and brown patients live in rural areas where we actually have to travel more than an hour to get to health care. So all of those are outside of the patient. I don't control where the nearest doctor is. Somebody else is making those choices. I don't control if I can see a midwife. Somebody else is deciding if my insurance will reimburse a midwife. I don't control if I can see a doula. Somebody else is deciding what resources. And we know that those things improve health outcomes. But what I want to say, Lewis, is a lot of people attribute maternal health care challenges to access and not having access to insurance, not having access to prenatal care. But what I want to say is Black women in this country, even if we do have insurance, even if we do have health care, even if we do have an OB, we still die in hospitals in this country because somebody did not listen to us, because somebody did not listen to our partners. So some of the high profile celebrity cases of Black and brown women like Serena, she had access, she had the best doctors. She certainly was in good health. She certainly didn't have health insurance or diabetes that wasn't addressed. She still almost died in a hospital in this country because somebody didn't listen to her. when she knew she was having shortness of breath and had a history of blood clots in her lungs. So it's not just access, because even if we do have access, we still are at risk of not receiving equal care. Because when I'm in front of you, when I'm in front of you in your hospital, if you look at me, you don't see your mom, you don't see your sister, you don't see your friend, and you don't treat me the same way you would want somebody in your family treated, I'm not going to have a good health outcome, even if I do have access. So access is a huge problem. We need to address access in this country. We need to deal with the upstream impact way before you ever see me, making sure that I am taken care of. But we also need to make sure that if I am lucky enough to get into your hospital and be signed to bed and put on a monitor, that you pay attention when things are not right. And that's where biases come in. So even if we ensure everybody in this country has access, which we do need to make sure everybody in this country has access, once I have access, am I being treated by the same people? Am I treated by the same people who believe I don't deserve the same standard of care? Who believe that I don't deserve a healthy pregnancy? Who believe I'm here because it's my fault that I'm in preterm labor? And unfortunately, we know from the medical literature, there are healthcare professionals who believe you didn't take care of yourself, and that's why you're here. You didn't take care of your diabetes, and that's why you're here. You have too many children, and that's why you're here. And so we have a lot of work to do to unpack those thoughts that impact decision-making about our care.
So Dr. Terry, I want to click down just one more time on this, because you mentioned that you got to make sure that your doctor hears you and that they listen to you. For some people who will hear this podcast, they're like, what does that mean? Because they assume that when they go into a medical facility, that people are there to serve them and to listen to them. So can you just click down and give some insight to when you say you got to make sure that the medical professional hears you?
Yes. So one of the things I've started to do is just kind of empower people with like three questions to use with their healthcare providers when they're being seen. Because unfortunately, healthcare providers have a certain bias with respect to how much they think somebody understands about their healthcare. And we can use scripts to make the visit go easier. And so one of the things at the beginning of our 50% of pregnancies, we actually don't know that we were not planning for the pregnancy and we're like here now. But if we are planning for a pregnancy and we know that we're pregnant and we're interviewing physicians, I think in the very first visit, Black and brown women, all women, but especially Black and brown women, in that first visit, once you meet your physician, you learn about their hours, you learn about who's in the staff, you learn about what hospital they admit to. These are the typical questions we ask. I would say, hi, I'm a person of color in this country, and I'm very worried about the maternal health crisis. And I want to make sure I have the best pregnancy experience possible. What is your staff doing to make sure that women like me have a good outcome in their pregnancy? What is your staff doing? And they may say, we have done some implicit bias training. They may say, we are making sure that doulas are at the delivery. They may say, in addition to seeing me, we also are partnered with midwives. They may say, thank you so much for bringing that question. Who is your support person? Because I want to make sure you are being heard and we want to meet you and your support person. They need to say something besides, look, I'm doing the best I can. And, you know, nothing's 100%. They have to say something other than that. And if they say, and if they have some steps that they have taken, if they are totally stunned, or they say, okay, this is an angry Black woman, I don't want them in my practice. Well, good, glad we found this out before my baby got here. This is what we all needed to know. Thank you for your time. Good luck, and I'm gonna keep it moving. And then once you ask that first question, you need to say, what's your policy for after hours? What is your policy for closer to pregnancy? Who's gonna see me, you know, when it's time for me to deliver? But the first question I would say is, you know, I have done everything I can to make sure I have a healthy pregnancy. I'm here. I'm taking my prenatal vitamins. I'm seeing you. I'm watching my blood pressure. I'm exercising. What are you doing? Because I'm very worried about being a statistic in this country, and I don't want to be. So what are you doing?
Thank you for that. The P&G brand, Pampers, has committed to reducing maternal morbidity in our community. Why is it important that a brand like Pampers is committed to this goal?
One of the things I really, really love about my partnership with Pampers is, as we said at the beginning, you know, I'm a clinician. I am in the hospital. I'm taking care of preemies. I don't even deliver babies. People think I'm an OB, but I don't even deliver babies. Like, I get the baby once the baby is born, but babies don't just appear. Babies come from moms, birthing people. They come from families, and families come from communities. So I love my job, but every time I meet a preemie, I think, what could we have done to prevent this outcome for this family? And so being able to be a member of the Pampers Womb the World Advisory Board for the past 3 years has allowed me to impact the community before a baby or a mom or family ever comes to the hospital. So the reason is really important is because Pampers cares about everybody having a healthy pregnancy. They care about joy through the whole pregnancy experience, and they care about making sure everyone is centered in that experience, having the best outcome possible. And they understand having the best outcome possible relates to three areas: increasing awareness about this issue, partnering at hospital, and providing resources. So one of the first things that I was able to work on with Pampers was developing resources for Black and brown women that were culturally sensitive. They really updated a whole line of their resources so that when we open these pamphlets, when we read about these resources, we see us. We see that they understand that this is a crisis in the community for Black and brown women. They actually have links in there to let us know what questions should I ask? Who is a safe maternal health care provider? They also put money behind implicit bias training. I'm from Louisiana. Louisiana, Mississippi have some of the worst maternal health outcomes in this country. And they have partnered with March of Dimes to do implicit bias training for healthcare providers. Over 4,000 providers trained so much just to talk about, we don't actually understand how we've been exposed to stereotypes and how they're embedded in the way we provide care and make judgments about patients. And the feedback, just getting that aha moment, changing our language when we interact with families, changing our language and understanding that people want, everybody wants the same thing, to have a healthy pregnancy, and to stop judging people for the circumstances that have brought them where they are. So for Pampers to put money behind changing all their branding to really elevate conversations around Black and brown mothers in the birthing community, to put money behind training staff, to put money behind nursing scholarships to increase the number of, be more inclusive of people who are trained and supporting these populations is really exciting. They supported the Queen Collective movies, Black Birth. Being part of that documentary was really, really exciting. So I feel like when I'm in the hospital, I'm one-to-one. I'm doing the most I can one-to-one. But I know that when I'm partnering with Procter & Gamble and that they are using their monies to change upstream as well as downstream, the impact on whole communities and families and to improve equity. If at the end of the day, all we did was empower someone to have their voice, and then empower a healthcare provider to say, you are safe. You are safe when you're here. I feel like I am doing my job. So that's why it's so important. And I think other Fortune 500 companies need to do the same thing. You have employees who have families, who have children. You want your employees to be there. You don't want your employees to die as a result of something like building a family and wanting to have a healthy pregnancy.
Dr. Terry, you also are an author, and you have a recent book, Full Circle Moments. Tell us some of the lessons that you expound on in that book.
So that book was really, really special to me. I actually started doing pediatric hospice in addition to neonatology about a year ago, and was inspired to write that book because I had been doing neonatology for 20 years and felt a calling to do more pediatric and perinatal hospice, and was just reflected on all the things I've learned from that I did not learn in medical school. So one of the things that I learned, which I grew up in the South, I grew up in the church, and I'm a Christian, but one of the things I learned from families, when you're talking to families and having really, really hard conversations, is having a hard conversation with the family is fine. Families don't have an issue with hard conversations. They accept information as you present it to them. But families want you to understand that they are guided. Many families are guided by a higher power. And they want you to offer the information, but they want you to also see them and respect their decision making. So what families have taught me is that I am a vessel. I'm a conduit. I am here to do what I've been trained to do. But once I've done what I've been trained to do, I am there to be by their side through the journey and support their decisions. So parents have taught me to support their decisions. People will say to me, well, neonatology, that's so sad. I mean, babies are sick and sometimes babies die. And it's true. Sometimes my patients do die, but I meet an angel every day. Sometimes they go home with the family. Sometimes they don't, but I am in the presence. I am reminded every day that I am a human, that I am just human. It's very humbling. And families have taught me that. Families have given me strength. I'm sometimes crying more than the families. The families are like, Doc, it's going to be Doc, it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. So they've given me that kind of strength. The other thing that I've learned is that this job, and this is what I tell medical students, and hopefully I can share this with the community, will be inspired by this. I've wanted to be a doctor since I was a little girl, but that is just my profession. It's not the sum of who I am. And none of these jobs, nobody's job is worth losing yourself over for a job. What are the things that really give you joy? We're human beings, not human doings. And when you're in a healthcare field, it's very easy to be a human doing. So the other lessons that families have taught me is what really matters at the end of the day. It's my family. It's my children. It's my community. Those are the things that really, really matter at the end of the day. It's not this job. And what choices am I making as I build my legacy so that my children, my family, my community understands that none of this is worth losing our lives, losing our hope, losing our joy. And the last thing that I've learned in the 20 years is we get to write our own story. We get to write our own story. When I first left medical school, I was told that one path was going to be my only path. And in fact, when I started doing more public speaking, when I started working with companies like March of Dimes and Pampers, when I started writing books, my mentor said to me, you just threw away your career. Like, this is the box I have for you, and you didn't want to be in this box. But I'm not in a box. I get to choose. We all get to choose. And we have different seasons for whatever our calling is, where we have a choice to leave our legacy. And I'm doing this now, but I may be doing something else in 10 years because I'm guided by an inner light. And so I'm hoping people understand if they're reinventing themselves and they're finding a new path, that you get to decide what that path is. You get to decide what joy looks like for you. You get to decide what difference you make every day. And so I'm the same Dr. Cherry in the classroom as I am in the patient room, as I am at church, as I am at home. And so authenticity is really important. So just learning that I'm a conduit, being very humble, that life is short. What are the things that give us joy? And understanding that I get to reinvent my path every day, and that it's okay to cry, and it's okay to take some time for myself, and it's okay to come back and do it differently.
Dr. Terry, we here at Waymaker believe that every successful person has had a Waymaker, at least one. And clearly you are successful. Who are some of your Waymakers?
I would say my first Waymakers were my mom and dad. I mean, growing up as a little brown girl in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, being the first medical doctor in the family. When I told my parents I wanted to be a doctor, they were like, girl, you ain't gonna be able to be. They were like, okay, you want to be a doctor, you're going to do that. They never painted a picture for me of what I couldn't achieve, even though we didn't have the most means. I mean, my great aunt didn't even have indoor plumbing. The cousins, we went over there and took a bath in one big tub together during the summers. And that was like fun to us. I could remember moving into the house I grew up in having carpet, and it was brick. Our other house was wood. Like, you couldn't tell us nothing. We had carpet now and central air. But they were the first Waymakers. They were praying. They were praying parents, and their belief elevated me. The second Waymaker was Dr. George Brown at Prairie View. He called me on the phone and said, if you come to Prairie View, I'll make sure you get to medical school. Everybody in my family had gone to Southern or Grambling. So going to Prairie View, people was like, what in the entire, like, why? And so it was really, but I had never seen a Black doctor before meeting him. And the moment I got there, he poured into me. He made sure opportunities came to me. I got to go to Cornell one summer. I went to the CDC. I went to Tulane. I did a bunch of research, and he poured into me to make sure I achieved my dream. And then I got to UCLA. So I would say the two biggest waymakers have been my parents and Dr. Brown, my pre-med advisor. Along the way, I have had advisors. One of the things I struggled with in my career was, how do I be a doctor, a wife, and a mommy? You know, how do I balance all these? I met my husband in Los Angeles at the Carl's Jr. I was sitting there crying during my second year of medical school. He walked up and said, "Are you okay?" And I'm like, "I'm okay. Why are you talking to me?" He's like, "Because you don't look okay." And so I just started crying. And he sat down and talked to me, and we started a friendship. We ended up being great friends. And I would say that he is the third waymaker, because my career has, I've been very successful in my career, but I haven't been here by myself. And being married to a partner who is fine to let me shine, is fine to make sure everybody know that my wife is doing it and we are doing it together. We have a son who has some learning challenges, and my husband was a stay-at-home dad for many years to support him. He was very okay with switching roles if it was necessary. Our daughter just finished veterinarian school, and I think my husband being the foundation for my children to have stability has been a great way maker as well, because it has allowed me to do things in my career that I wouldn't have been able to do otherwise. And him being from Inglewood and me being from Louisiana, you know, he kind of ups my cool quotient a little bit. So that's been really, that has helped. But I mean, I think about Diana Ross in Mahogany, like, success is nothing if you don't have anybody to celebrate it with. So being able to celebrate that with my parents, being able to celebrate that with Dr. Brown, who's still teaching at Prairie View, still calls me, and being able to have my husband by my side through this crazy journey has just been amazing. So I will say that those have been the central way makers. But obviously I have my friends, my family, I have my sorority sisters. I have other Black women in medicine who I can talk to about, you know, I'm 25 years in now, and it's still pretty hard. So navigating spaces, making sure voices are being honored, making a way for other people to come behind us, and making sure new medical students, nurses, practitioners understand that you can do it. I did it and you can do it too. And make sure that we call out microaggressions and macroaggressions in this field. It's 2023 and we still need to do that. So, but we can't do it alone. And just normalizing self-care and how important our mental health is in navigating these journeys.
So we're going to close this out, Dr. Terry, but I would ask you to close it out with three things that women need to do when they find out they're pregnant.
So the first thing we need to do when we find out we're pregnant is identify a healthcare provider who we feel we can be safe with. So go for that first visit, that first prenatal appointment. Tell them about your concerns with Black maternal health mortality in this country, and ask them what they're doing in their office to make sure you seem safe, that you are safe. And if they say they haven't done anything yet, you can say, well, how do you feel about this crisis in this country? And hopefully they are as alarmed as you are. The second thing is really important, is identify who your support person is. One of the things we learned during the pandemic, when we restricted visitors, is Black women were having to deliver alone, and how much that impacted their pregnancy journey, not having their partner being able to advocate, come check on my partner, we're worried about this is going on, et cetera. That's the second thing. The third thing, and I think this is really important because people think about just the delivery, is after you have the baby, and you are home, understand that the risk to our lives does not stop with the delivery. The risk to our lives really goes on. Maternal mortality is through the first year after having the baby. So make sure that we have a plan in place to make sure that we're getting our postpartum checkups, making sure we're being seen afterwards. Certainly if we have high blood pressure, diabetes, or other issues, making sure that those are being addressed, and normalizing our self-care. Black women carry a lot of stress, and we know that these cumulative stresses can lead to preterm birth, can affect our blood pressure, et cetera. So making sure we identify a safe provider, making sure we know who our partner's gonna be, Number three, making sure we're seeing someone after we have the baby too. And then protecting our mental health, our self-care. Let somebody else do it, sis. Sometimes it's okay to say no, take a nap. I don't do yoga, but I know how to turn off the TV, turn off the phone, and turn off the computer. So protect our safe spaces and make sure that we are protecting our joy through that journey. And if they need resources for how to find a safe provider, we do have some resources for how to identify a safe maternal health care provider and some of the resources we develop with Pampers and Procter & Gamble.
Dr. Terry, how can women reach out to you?
So the easiest way to reach out to me is through my website. The website is Dr. Terry MD, drterrimd.com. That's the easiest way to reach out to me. My professional email is the same, drterrymd@gmail.com. If you're feeling adventurous, you can just type out Terry Major Kincaid. There's only one in the world. I really like that. MAJOR-KINCADE. And it'll bring you to my website too as well. For those who are wondering, I'm not in the Army. Major was my maiden name. And I was the first medical doctor. My dad asked me to keep Major, so I did. So that's Dr. Major Kincaid.
Dr. Terry, we thank you so much for sharing with us today. But we also really thank you for doing the work that you do every single day. That's the most important thing. And we thank Pampers for introducing you to us. And we appreciate the work and the partnership that they have with you. So thank you, Dr. Terry, and have a great, 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 successful, more successful career as you continue your work with Black and Brown communities. We appreciate you.
Thank you for having me, Lewis. I'm super inspired by what you're doing too. And I will never hear the word Waymaker again and not think about you. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for listening to this conversation between Lewis Carr and Dr. Major Kincaid. What did you enjoy about this episode? Let us know on our social media at Waymaker Culture. Don't forget to claim your Waymaker Journal at waymakerjournal.com and be sure to enter the Waymaker Giveaway by going to waymakercontest.com. Subscribe to the Waymaker Fireside Chat Podcast to get notifications each time we release an episode.